I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to part 4 of 4 on reconsidering Russia. Today, we are going to talk about U.S.-Russia relations. On the last episode, we talked a little bit more about Russian relations with all of its more immediate neighbors, and now we're going to talk about Russia-U.S.
Yeah, this is the one you've all been waiting for, the bromance of the bad hombres. What we're going to actually do is talk a little bit about the relationship between the United States and Russia post-Cold War, focusing on political leaders, so starting with Bush and Gorbachev and ending with Trump and Putin. And we've got a really heavy hitter with us this time to take us through that recent history and do a little bit of predicting with us. His name is Steven Sestanovich. He's a senior fellow for Russian Eurasian Studies on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's written a book. He's been a professor. And he's actually worked with the Reagan administration on Russia. So the guy has been through the weeds. He knows what he's talking about. We're really excited to have him.
Before we get into it, remember a little bit of housekeeping. You can find us on social media on Facebook and Twitter at ReconsiderPod. That's at ReconsiderPod for both.
We'd love to hear from you. We also have a Patreon account, so you can log on to patreon.com/reconsider, and you can give us your money. We always ask for $1 a show, just like Dan Carlin. And if you want to give even more, we've got some great perks for the people that have been donating a little bit more, including, at our highest level, the Reconsider Cabinet, where once a month you get to hop on a Google Hangout with us, ask us some questions about the show, about the world, give us some advice and feedback, tell us what you want us to talk about. It's the last one was a ton of fun. I'd love to have more of you.
So without further ado, let's get to it. This is our interview with Steven Sestanovich.
So today's guest is Steven Sestanovich, the George F. Keenan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the Catherine and Shelby Colum Davis Professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. He has been a senior senatorial legislative assistant, policy planner at the Department of State during the Reagan administration, and senior director for policy development at the U.S. National Security Council. He has served as ambassador-at-large and special advisor to the Secretary of State for the new independent states of the former Soviet Union under Madeleine Albright. He's also the author of Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. You'll find his name all over contemporary journalism, and he got his bachelor's from Cornell and his PhD in government from Harvard. You might want to rewind and listen to all of that again. It's quite a CV. Steven, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So today, we're going to be talking about Russia's contemporary relation with the U.S. Our last show covered more regional geopolitics with Russia, and this will be our fourth and final episode. So we're going to talk about what's happened, especially after the Cold War, between the U.S. and Russia, to give a little context to the current relationship that is developing with Trump. So let's start at the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Union was dismantled under Gorbachev, and the U.S. was, you know, feeling pretty good. We were the preponderant superpower. We had won this decades-long conflict, and Francis Fukuyama said that this is the end of history, right? Now, Stephen, you said in one piece that many considered the 90s to be a vacation from geopolitics, looking at it retrospectively. So what did you mean by that, and what do you think about that now?
Let me answer that in a second, but let's go back to the end of history, because people often misunderstand what that means. And I think it's worth pausing for just a second to clarify. Yes, we won the kind of battle of ideas that was underlying the Cold War. And liberal ideas, democratic ideas, who were thought to be in the ascendant, victorious all around the world. But embodying those ideas in working institutions was another matter. And it turned out that it was actually a rather difficult matter in many post-communist societies. And that gets to the broader question that you asked, which is, was it a vacation from geopolitics? Well, only if viable institutions could be created that would make it possible for countries to work, for political, social, economic systems to be created that satisfied their people, that allowed relations with neighbors to be peaceful and cooperative. And the 90s were not really all about peace and cooperation. Actually, there was a lot of concern that the Cold War was going to be followed by an era of ethnic conflict, of new geopolitical rivalry. Many academic experts and real-life politicians wondered whether the revival of Germany as a unified power and as the seemingly the dominant economic power on the European continent would create all kinds of new stabilities. Empires often break up, the result is chaos. And people didn't know whether that was going to be true of the breakup of the Soviet Union.
As the Soviet Union started to break up, we know Gorbachev during this era was fighting the total dismantling of the Union, but he failed. And so at this point, we have Bush 41 in charge, trying to manage the breakup of the Union in a way that was going to lead to a peaceful outcome rather than total chaos. And so how did Bush see this period, and did he try to help Gorbachev? Was he trying to help Yeltsin dismantle it? How did he try to work with Russia in order to manage this transition?
Well, Bush was seen as a great Gorbachev booster. He went to Moscow to show his support. He went to Kiev and criticized the Ukrainians for suicidal nationalism. He was actually an advocate of the view that holding the Soviet Union together was necessary for stability. People in the Bush entourage didn't like Yeltsin at all. They thought he was a dissolute, self-interested political troublemaker. And so to the extent that the U.S. could put its finger on the scales, they were voting for Gorbachev. But in reality, the American vote didn't count for very much, because the internal dynamics of Soviet politics turned out to be a lot more important. And when Gorbachev's own conservative party backers turned against him, the result was a national division, and Yeltsin carried the day. The people were with Yeltsin and wanted to put the communist order behind him.
Given what was going on, what was the United States' biggest concern as it lost, as Gorbachev lost his grip on the Union and it fell apart? What did Bush do with Gorbachev and then Yeltsin to try to maintain peace in Europe?
Well, there were a number of concerns, as you can imagine, when a big system like this fails. It creates a lot of collateral damage. Nobody knows what the hell is going on. So one part of the U.S. government was especially worried about nuclear weapons. Where would the weapons that had been outside of the territory of Russia in Ukraine and Kazakhstan, where would they end up? Who would control them? Another part of the U.S. government was worried about economic viability for the new countries of the Soviet Union. The State Department was particularly worried about creating some recognition and standing for the new countries of the Soviet Union. And so Secretary Baker made a pilgrimage, a tour of all of the new capitals to announce the diplomatic recognition and the formation of U.S. embassies. The whole of the U.S. government is particularly concerned about political stability. The question was, could you, in the wake of the Soviet collapse, actually create a smooth transition to new working societies and political systems? And that had people on edge. They didn't know what the right instruments would be, what the right political and other diplomatic strategies would be to actually create working partners for the for U.S. and European governments.
So following this, Russia obviously did find itself in a weak point. It's really when its economy began to suffer and started to dole out different assets to what people are now calling the oligarchs. And a lot of people are saying that it was in this time that the West took advantage of Russia's weakness to expand NATO, include Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic. Now, you've stated before that you believe that enlargement was a major American policy achievement. And I bring that up because there's a lot of people saying, you know, today, well, look, you know, look at what the U.S. does. Obviously, Russia's feeling it this way. But you say this and then also say that it's nevertheless been, quote, marred by mistakes and costs that were higher than expected. So what did you mean by this?
Go back for a second. Because you asked what kind of help was given. In the first instance, American and Western governments thought that you needed to have economic assistance. And some of this was, from the Russian point of view, of others, other countries in the former Soviet Union, somewhat humiliating. This was a big psychological jolt for them. The idea that they were receiving food aid from the United States, the famous bush legs, you know, frozen chicken to keep body and soul together in the Russian Federation during a hard winter. This was a kind of psychological jolt to people that they could hardly imagine. And I remember a Russian friend of mine saying to me at the time, don't feed us, because that was a relationship of such humiliating dependency that she thought Russians would not cope with it well. Now, more broadly about the issue of NATO enlargement, here's the problem. The United States settled on, for reasons that I'll mention in a second, a very hard strategy. And that strategy was to try to integrate the countries of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union as much as possible into existing international institutions. It didn't think that it could do that all at once with all of them. It thought they had to meet certain criteria, readiness, eligibility to be part of those institutions. But it wanted to make sure that the ones that were left out, that might be only ready for membership late down the road, would not be estranged. So it wanted to have a policy of maximum integration, but also of good relations with everybody who wasn't integrated. And of course, the most dramatic version of this was taking some of the countries of the former Soviet bloc into NATO and not Russia, which, by the way, wasn't sure it wanted to be in NATO. The American approach was very ambitious. it thought it had to do this because it believed that stability depended on not just having a gray zone in which no countries knew where their security would come from, in which the countries of Eastern Europe felt they were kind of left out of international order. Instead, the thought was they need to feel as though they're citizens in good standing of the modern democratic world. And at the same time, American policymakers thought they should reach out as much as possible to Russia, to deepen cooperation with Russia, to show signs of respect for it as a nation, as a culture, show signs of respect for its leaders, bring it into whatever institutions it would be integrated into, and in that way create an expectation of cooperation and new feeling. You can say this was a doomed enterprise, and some people say that today. I think it was a hard enterprise. It was an ambitious one, and it needed maybe a lot of luck to work, but it certainly didn't fail because there was no effort or no commitment to it. American policymakers, Clinton administration, Bush administration, and both Bush administrations, saw Russia as a country that needed to be shown respect, that needed to feel it was part of the West, and that the way to do this was by active American leadership. Now, there was a downside to this, of course. It made the United States look as though it was the boss of everybody. It made it easy for Russians to say, you know, they're treating us as though we're the losers. But the underlying thought was, let's act as though the Russians were not the losers. Let's act as though Yeltsin is our buddy, as though Putin is our buddy, as though Russia and the United States can be friends and partners.
And given all this outreach, what was the relationship like in the Clinton-Yeltsin years, and especially early in the Bush-Putin years? Did they seem to have a cordial working relationship where they were, you know, really seeing each other as partners to, you know, solve the issues that existed both between them and in Europe as a whole? Were there strains and frustrations between the administrations, even beyond the frustration that Russians felt on the ground?
Sure. Look, we tend to remember Yeltsin as our pal, and we think of Putin as a creep. And so we tend to think, oh, the relationship with Putin has always been bad, and with Yeltsin it must have been good. It's true that Clinton and Yeltsin had basically amicable relationship. There was a reason it was called the Bill and Boris show. But it had its awkwardnesses and difficulties. Yeltsin had to retain his independence for his political standing at home. He had to show he could talk back to the United States when Russia disagreed with his policy. And he did that. Russians were conflicted about this entire enterprise, and they didn't want to make it seem as though they were just the junior partner. So Yeltsin frequently blasted the United States for doing things that he disagreed with. Similarly, Putin, the relationship between him and Bush was actually often as cordial and in some ways easier than between Bush and then between Clinton and Yeltsin, partly because Putin is a less volatile personality. He and Bush were able to find a working accommodation in the early years of the Bush 43 administration. You know, Condi Rice said this may be the best period of Russian-American relations ever, and she didn't mean there were no problems, but just that the strategy that I've described, which is using American power to integrate as many states as possible while having the best possible relations with the big state that wasn't fully integrated, she thought, and a lot of people would have told you at the time, that relationship was working.
So this relationship seemed to be working in the 90s. Did the U.S. intervention in the Balkans in 1999 change the trajectory of that relation?
Yeah, I was at the State Department at the time, and I remember giving a little talk to worried think tankers here in Washington who thought, oh my God, this is changing the trajectory of the U.S.-Russia relationship, just as you've asked. Huh. And my message to them at the time was, look, when the United States uses force in a way that Russia doesn't agree with, doesn't have this approval of the UN Security Council, where the Russians had their veto, one of their big geopolitical tools left to them after the collapse of the Soviet Union. When all that happens, the Russians are bound to criticize. They're bound to get off the bus of Russian-American cooperation. And for as long as the American use of force continues, they will stay off the bus. And then when it's over, they'll get back on the bus. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in the Kosovo War. The Russians actually participated in the settlement of it and with representatives of the EU and the State Department. Yeltsin came to a G7 meeting in Germany for a laying on of hands to say, we now embrace the solution of the Kosovo problem as united members of the international community and as members of the Security Council. So it didn't actually have this kind of devastating effect on the Russian-American relationship. In fact, in some ways, it seemed to strengthen it. Both Russia and the United States, for example, participated as key peacekeepers in Kosovo. And the following year, Clinton came to Moscow for a summit meeting with Putin, at which he visited Yeltsin, and there was a show of good cheer and of good feeling. And then, as I said, in the early Bush administration, there was a kind of new high reached for Russian-American relations. So the problem of Russian disagreements with American military operations remained. And you saw it again in the Iraq War. But even that didn't end the idea of Russian-American partnership. It, when the war was over, the Russians were prepared to get back on the bus again.
So at some point, the common narrative goes that during the second Bush administration, the relationship between the United States and Russia started to break down, in part highlighted by the fact that there was the big reset button pressed at the beginning of the Obama administration with Secretary Clinton. So what was the main driver? Well, was there a breakdown in the relationship? Was it driven in part by the Orange Revolution, trying to bring Georgia into NATO or something else? Or was it not as bad as people thought?
I think it was bad, but it was maybe not irreparable. The Orange Revolution was a big, big shock to the Russians. Because what it said to them was, you can have a kind of popular uprising to throw out pro-Soviet, please forgive that expression, pro-Russian political leaders who've lost touch with the people. That's what happened in the 2004 election. Remember, it was a massive show of popular disapproval for essentially vote rigging that would have given the presidency to Viktor Yanukovych, who will return to our story later. Viktor Yanukovych was the candidate of the pro-Russian political forces in Ukraine, and he was denied the presidency because such big crowds formed in Kiev demanding a new round of balloting. And that was, for the Russians, a shock. The idea that that's how politics would be decided in the streets through popular protests with voting that couldn't be manipulated by the state. This was an immense blow to them. And it created a kind of ideology of anti-Western interference, because they thought, aha, this is bad what's happened in Ukraine. A new government hostile to Russia had been installed. But it wasn't the first time. They thought that the same thing had happened in Georgia the year before, where crowds had protested rigged elections, and then you'd had a more pro-Western leadership come in. So Putin began to develop this thought that the West was fixed on regime change. And this term, which had been applied, of course, to Saddam Hussein, came to be his unifying indictment of American policy, that the United States was going around trying to bring down governments that it didn't approve of. Now, in reality, the U.S. government had next to nothing to do with the Orange Revolution, or with the Rose Revolution in Georgia before it. But Putin became increasingly concerned that this was the thrust of Western policy designed ultimately to bring him down.
So was the development of this Russian perception of the West as intent on regime change and locking it in, is this what led Russia to invade Georgia, fear of either NATO expansion or Western influence in that region? And how did that impact how the West saw Russia after this event?
Yeah, the invasion of Georgia by Russian troops is one of those subjects, like NATO enlargement in general, like the Orange Revolution, like many other episodes of Russian-American disagreement in this period. It's going to have scholars and practitioners arguing for years and years. There were many other Russian grievances in Georgia besides native enlargement. After all, you'd had Russian troops in these two separatist parts of Georgia for 15 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. That had mostly been a peaceful collapse, but in some cases where there was division and separatism in the new states of the former Soviet Union, the Russians actually sent in forces to try to stabilize things and to create create enclaves of opposition to governments that they didn't have complete confidence in. And that was true in Georgia. There were Russian troops in South Ossetia and in Abkhazia. And those had been a source of disagreement between the government, the Georgian government in Tbilisi, and the Russian government in Moscow for years. And the Georgians had been trying to get those so-called peacekeepers out, and the Russians had been determined to keep them in. So there was a lot of jockeying back and forth. You could have had this sort of, sort of explosion of violence. It was a war that only lasted 4 days, 5 days. But I think it's probably fair to say that that Putin felt especially aggrieved that months earlier at a NATO summit in Bucharest, the West had declared that eventually Georgia and Ukraine would be part of NATO. This was a weird, mishandled episode, because actually the real message of that summit to the Russians was we're not going to bring them into NATO. There had been too much division within the alliance, and they couldn't agree on adding these members. So they just kicked the can down the road and said, well, someday they'll be part of NATO. But the truth is, NATO governments were not at all prepared to have Georgia be part of the alliance, and if the Russians had understood things better, I think they probably did understand this, they would have known that the Germans, the French, others would never allow it to happen. But all the same, It was a kind of goad to Putin. It gave him a reason to try to bring down Mikhail Saakashvili, who was the president of Georgia, somebody who did not get along with Putin at all. And so you had this explosion. And people in the West were stunned because it didn't seem just like another bit of Russian interference in a neighboring country. It seemed like aggression. People started talking about Putin as the new Hitler, comparing this to the dismemberment of Austria and of Czechoslovakia in the late 30s. There was a kind of hysteria is not too strong a word. And there was the same sort of agitation in Russia. Putin himself probably made a big mistake right afterwards. He decided to recognize these two breakaway parts of Georgia as independent countries, something that Russian officials and diplomats told me in Moscow right afterwards. You know, they knew he was going too far, but it was a brainless, emotional thing to do. But that it was a kind of symptom of where the relationship was heading. It was becoming a kind of grudge match between Russia and the West, and where it was a little more difficult to control the dynamics than either side fully appreciated or really should.
So the dialogue becomes a little bit more challenging between the two countries. Obama takes office and seeks this reset button.
Yeah.
What was Obama attempting to achieve with a reset with Medvedev? It looked like it was working for a while, and have things been going in the right direction? And if not, what has changed since then?
Well, the reset was a decision to try to put aside the Georgian disagreement, the emotions, the anger that had been sparked on both sides by that flare-up in the summer of 2008, and to try to calm the relationship down, to return it in a way to what I described earlier as the strategy that the United States had followed really since the end of the Cold War, and that is to have the best possible cooperative relationship with Russia that you could sustain without compromising fundamental Western interests. And so the Obama administration very carefully addressed a number of specific issues on which it thought it was possible to make progress. It wanted overflight rights for the support of American forces in Afghanistan, for example. Wanted to get a new strategic arms control treaty. Both of those things turned out to be pretty easy to do. And a new atmosphere was created for Russian-American relations, in which it was possible to, for example, consult closely on the problem of Iran's nuclear program, in which it was possible to make progress in getting Russia at long last into the World Trade Organization. It seemed as though a transactional approach was going to be possible as a way of pulling the relationship back from the emotional impasse, the charged strategic impasse that the Russian-Georgian War had brought it to. It looked as though in the strategy that I was.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Describing earlier was going to work again, get a new lease on life.
But then things seem to have gone to hell in the past few years.
Absolutely. They genuinely went to hell. Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of events happened. There was the Maidan Revolution. And what I don't know is how much the U.S. might have actually been directly or indirectly involved in that. Followed, of course, by the invasion of Crimea, the invasion of eastern Ukraine, and Russian involvement in Syria to prop up the Assad regime, all of which were direct military confrontations that headbutted with American policy interests and even at times put us at risk of shooting each other by mistake. So what the heck happened?
Look, what happened in Ukraine is the pivotal part of this story. Without it, you get Russian-American disagreements, scratchiness, periods of estrangement, but not any fundamental rupture. With Ukraine, you get a complete turning point. There were disagreements before Ukraine. Remember, there was the Magnitsky Bill. There was concern about repression in Russia. There were the rigged elections of 2011, which produced demonstrations in Russia, a sign that Putin's government was not as legitimate as it pretended to be. It depended on electoral manipulation. But those were manageable differences, I would argue, ones that would challenge policymakers, but wouldn't bring down the whole edifice of the regime. Ukraine was different. Even the disagreement that the U.S. and Russia had over Snowden, which was the summer before the events in Ukraine, was a bit of unpleasantness, but it wasn't a fundamental threat to the relationship of the sort that Ukraine became. Now, why did the Ukraine events loom so large? Not because the United States had attached a whole lot of importance to Ukraine. Actually, Ukraine was a real backwater of U.S. policy in years, in the whole entire Obama administration leading up to 2014. Rather little attention had been paid to it. And when American officials started paying more attention to the Maidan demonstrations, it was as a kind of late-in-the-game realization that something big was going on here. The issue had been, would Ukraine tilt toward the EU in trade and economic terms, or toward Russia? And that, in Ukraine, morphed into a fundamental challenge to the regime. The Maidan demonstrations started out as a protest of Yanukovych's decision to orient toward Russia economically rather than toward the EU. But they morphed into something more fundamental, a challenge to Yanukovych's rule. And the way in which that happened was through the very clumsy, totally counterproductive use of force against demonstrators. The Maidan demonstrations stopped being about trade, which is generally a problem you can solve by having a lot of experts consult. And they became instead about abuse of power, impunity by illegitimate officials. Ultimately, Yanukovych had to flee the country because every single member of the Ukrainian parliament voted to remove him. Putin doesn't like to recall those facts. He likes to think of it as an American coup. But in reality, what happened was it was like the Orange Revolution on steroids. You had a popular consensus that the people in charge were corrupt, illegitimate, and had to go. And at that point, there was no way around the situation except to have a change of leadership. It had been a revolution. You had had groups in the streets that brought down the government. But it was for reasons that really had more to do with the actions of that government than with any outside interference. Putin, will never believe this, but you know, actually American officials weren't too interested in Ukraine. They became very interested when it became an issue of Russia's retaliation, which was the conquest of Crimea, the support of separatist insurgent forces in eastern Ukraine, and what looked like possibly an effort to dismember the entire Ukrainian state. Here again, as in 2008, you had people saying, you know, Putin is the new Hitler. This was overdone. My view is it's never good to compare anybody to Hitler, but there was a much more dramatic urgency to this problem, because it did look as though Russia was in the business of conquering the territory of its neighbors.
So we've seen obviously a more active Russia in the last several years. I mean, the acquisition of Crimea, and as you said, lots of people said, oh, well, it's just like Hitler's, the first time borders have moved since World War II, despite whatever historical differences, you know, might obviously also be there. But then something that I kind of think really threw a lot of folks in the West was when Russia got involved in Syria. What is Russia doing there, and how is this related to what's going on in the Ukraine, and how are we trying to solve the Russian intervention there now?
Yeah, look, if you sat Putin down and you said, is there some common theme, unifying thread to Ukraine and Syria, he would say, yes, it's Western support for regime change. The idea that Western governments can pick winners and losers in other countries and bring down the people that they don't like. You know, here too, the truth of what happened in Syria was not that Western governments decided they've had it with President Assad and decided to bring him down. It's that you had a popular uprising, not so different from what you had in Ukraine. The Color Revolution weren't so different from the Arab Spring. Across the Arab world, with no prompting, Western governments, people got mad at their leaderships, and that ultimately became the Syrian civil war. For Putin, looking at this situation, where there were, you know, there were definite efforts after incredible atrocities by the Assad regime, efforts by Western governments to promote a peaceful resolution, and then to promote armed groups that would be able to defend themselves against the regime. For Putin, this was a case of defending your guy. I mean, Putin is he has a kind of simple approach to politics, which is, you know, if you're on my side, I will fight for you, and if you're not on my side, you know, to hell with you. His idea about Assad was he and his family had been friends of the Soviet Union and then of Russia. And that was a cooperative relationship that he was prepared to invest in heavily to support. There's a little base there, not much of a base, on the Syrian coast that Russian Navy uses. But the core of it was supporting a client state against outside pressure and even against internal pressure. You could say especially against internal pressure. The dramatic step that Putin took, of course, was bringing Russian military forces into the fight, which he did quite late in the game when it looked as though Assad might be about to go down. I don't think Putin would have done that if he hadn't been quite sure that the United States was not going to intervene against him. So in that respect, there's a kind of connection between the famous 2013 red line, which the Obama administration made clear, we are not getting involved in this story, even though you have a major violation of the international convention on use of chemical weapons. Seeing that the United States was not going to act, Putin was able to take action confidently. He could do something that the Soviet Union had never done, which is a massive military operation in a country of the Middle East in order to support a client, get the resolve a major civil war, and for him, this has been an enormous demonstration of the revival of Russian power. Something that no Soviet leader could do, something that was vastly beyond the capabilities of Yeltsin, Putin showed could be done under his revived Russia. It helped that he had been able to increase Russian military spending by 100% in the 10 years prior to that. It helped that he knew that Western governments really didn't want to get it. But all the same, it was a sign, a message to the Russian body politic, we're back. We're back on the international stage in a way that you never imagined would be possible 20 years earlier.
So at this point, Russia and U.S. relations have hit a serious nadir. I remember people talking about World War III coming up, and that rhetoric has only grown sort of more hysterical as the new sheriff in the United States has come to town, and boy, does he know how to make a deal. We, of course, are talking about Trump. And what's interesting is that among all the concern among the American public about the United States and Russia, it varies actually between a hot conflict and sort of on one end and to the other end, Trump being a Manchurian candidate and Putin's puppet. So before we get into dissecting what their relationship is actually like, Russia was obviously happier with Trump getting elected than Clinton. And what do they expect out of a relationship with Trump, or what are they hoping for? And are Trump and Putin, actually friends, and will they get along?
Okay, a lot of questions there. Let's just go back to, as a way into this problem, to the World War III specter that you mentioned, because it is true that over the past couple of years, much more in Russia than here, by the way, there's been a lot of apocalyptic talk about this coming confrontation, not just of a new Cold War, but of a new hot war. And I think it's important to understand where that came from. It didn't come just from Syria, although that made it bad, and it didn't come just from Ukraine, but from the sustained sense that the Russia and the United States and behind it the NATO alliance were on this kind of collision course that wasn't disciplined by any agreement on rules, that had a kind of civilizational dimension to it. I mean, Russian discourse on the international politics has been really weird in the past couple of years. You have a very sober and kind of serious-minded academic interpreters, journalistic interpreters, even more so, talking about a kind of explosion in the relationship that, you know, frankly, I don't think has ever been particularly likely in between the two. But they've worked themselves into this kind of lather because of Russia's isolation, because what I think of as quite serious mistakes on the part of Putin, who let a disagreement over Ukraine turn into a fundamental confrontation in Europe between Russia and NATO, so that the government in Europe that he has had the best relations with over, you know, many, many years, that is Germany, has now become one of the leaders of the anti-Russian movement, you know, convinced supporters of sanctions against Russia and so forth, backers of troop deployments in Eastern Europe to show the Russians that they have to stop pushing on small neighbors. This has created a kind of apocalyptic atmosphere in which people think of Russia as sort of fundamentally at odds with the West across the board. And it has given license, I think, people who study this more closely than I do, I think in particular it kind of gave a license to hysterical Russian propaganda efforts, probably to the intelligence agencies that undertook the hacking of the DNC. There's now an atmosphere of relations with policy toward the West, which anything goes, you know. Supporting political candidates of populist parties in Western Europe. The money flows. The hysterical propaganda is out there. The idea, and in here there's a kind of convergence between Putin's rhetoric and Trump's rhetoric, which is that, you know, the global system is rigged. Elites benefit, and everybody else gets screwed. So Putin, in this telling of the world events, becomes the global populist, like Trump, protesting the powers that be and their self-dealing. Putin hates the EU. Trump's ideologists, like Steve Bannon, seem to regard the EU as especially odious institution, which is transnational in a way that they especially hate. So you had through this period of confrontation with the West, a kind of embrace by Putin of very populist rhetoric, of anti-elite rhetoric, of challenging the established order, in a way that brought him close to people who were in the West hostile to existing policy. He didn't like the Obama administration. He didn't want Hillary Clinton. He thought that somehow you could find a way out of this. Now, what are they... This is all a great rhetoric for Putin, who probably thought, by the way, that Hillary Clinton was going to win, but he wanted to use that result as proof that the system was rigged. Once Trump won, what could Putin expect to get out of it? Well, lots, actually. He wanted to get sanctions removed. He wanted to get a kind of pullback of support from the U.S. of cooperation in Europe. He wanted to get a kind of recess of efforts to enlarge NATO. He wanted to get a recognition of Russia's sphere of influence on its periphery. He wanted to get an acceptance of Russia as a big player in the Middle East. All of these are traditional Russian objectives, but given this, they were given this extra bit of nationalist hysteria and energy by the way the confrontation in Ukraine had developed. This has been for Russia a period almost of kind of recasting the legitimacy of the regime. You know, there's a term in Russia, the Crimean Consensus. What that means is that Russia found a new nationalist confidence, a sense of its legitimacy after the seizure of Crimea, based on not just on taking this little bit of territory, because actually what's a tiny bit of territory like that, based especially on being able to assert itself against the West, defy the West, bear the brunt of Western sanctions, and though isolated, stand for something different in the world. That's the way Putin has tried to cast himself as the lonely hero against Western liberalism, which he portrays as decadent, corrupt, and so forth.
So speaking of rhetoric, another narrative that certainly pervaded the campaign period, in addition to the World War III thing, was, you know, Trump doesn't know anything about the world. How can you possibly let someone like this get his hand, you know, his finger on the nuclear button?
Yeah.
Now, I think, you know, there's that. That's a discussion in of itself. But now that he's in office, you know, he has Mattis and Tillerson. It seems like driving a big part of the strategy for the administration. What moves are you seeing these two guys doing in relation to Russia? Is it more aggressive than the Obama administration? Is it a completely different strategy, or is it a continuation?
I don't think I'm alone in saying that it's utterly unclear what the Trump administration's policy toward Russia would be, because they've had so many different versions of what it is that they're up to. You can hear their ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, talking about preserving sanctions and requiring the rollback of the Crimean annexation. You can hear General Mattis reaffirming American commitments to NATO in contradiction to Trump's claim that NATO was obsolete. You have Secretary Tillerson talking pretty tough in his Senate confirmation hearings. What it is that Trump wants, I think, is and intends to do, very unclear, and it's especially unclear now because the effort has engendered so much controversy that it's not clear this is a political winner for him. Nor is it clear that the Russians are confident that he can deliver. You know, other governments always are happy when the President of the United States embraces their perspective and seems to suggest that a lot of their positions can be embraced in American policy. But no government likes to discover that when the President says that, everybody else rises up in horror, including his own advisors, and raise doubts about whether the President can deliver. Right now, the Russians are having not so much buyer's remorse about Trump, but they're having a real doubt as to whether this is a guy who actually can manage the policy process in a way that does them any good. You know, has anti-Russian sentiment in the United States increased since Trump became president, or decreased? Well, there are some signs that, you know, public opinion, there's a little more favorable view of Putin among, you know, conservative Republicans. Other than that, you've had a deterioration of relations, even a demonization of Putin, people are inclined to believe the absolute worst about Russian manipulations in American politics. You have calls for a massive congressional investigation of Russian policy and corrupt ties between the president and Russian intelligence. This isn't good for the Russians. They don't like this. They fear this is a sign that all the hopes that they pinned on Trump are going to be disappointed.
Given that we don't know much about exactly what Trump's intent is with Russia, and that there's a lot of disagreement within his cabinet about what to do, and that there's a lot of anti-U.S. sentiment towards Russia, it seems that, to some extent, Trump's hands are fairly tied. But even if they weren't, what could Trump try to get out of the relationship with Russia? Assuming that he's not just going to hand Russia whatever it wants, the United States has some cards, including sanctions, or some chips. Is there anything that Russia can give the United States under the Trump administration that would be positive?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the core of this is, of course, Ukraine. And I think there's, under other circumstances, there could be more hope for some rethinking on the part of the Russians about the entire enterprise in Ukraine. I don't mean here that they would think, oh, we can give up Crimea. Because as I said, that's a big achievement, and Putin thinks of it as, you know, a defining part of his legacy. But the whole adventure in eastern Ukraine has really been a loser. And Putin, who has, you know, not seen really much economic growth in the past several years, could easily make a decision that getting out from under sanctions would be worth a little backtracking in the East. This is something that he is not going to want to have look like an outright defeat. He can't eat crow just because, you know, he wants to get out from under sanctions. He's a politician like everybody else, and he's running for re-election. But could you find a way to make Trump's respect, shows of, you know, good feeling and cooperation toward Putin, a kind of cover for a rethinking of Russian policy? I would say, if I were advising Trump, I had things not spun so out of control, that would be something worth pursuing. And it can only work if Putin believes that he's not going to get a lifting of sanctions for free. Probably now he's resigned to that thought, unless there are big changes of government in Europe. And the sanctions will probably stay, and that's good for making Putin believe that he's got to give ground, that he's got to essentially get out of eastern Ukraine, right off that whole adventure, and let the Ukrainian government resume its administration of those territories. Are there other issues? Yeah. Putin, for a time after the New START treaty, negotiated with Obama in 2010, said he wasn't interested in any more. But that was before the Russian defense budget sort of hit hard times. And I think these days there's probably more interest on the part even of the Russian military, which has not been too interested in arms control, in actually resuming that dialogue. And it's almost necessary because the Russians are in violation of a number of other treaties. You've got to put the dialogue back together in a way that allows everybody to put their grievances on the table. The Russians have their own grievances. And it may not be possible to produce any kind of new agreement But you can get that sort of stabilizing effect from the resumption of some of these issues. I think it'll be harder for Trump to do what he said is his big goal, which is to develop an alliance against terrorism. It's not worthless to try to talk about that and find some practical ways of turning it into reality. I think it's merely, you know, not so likely right now. To make it more likely, the U.S. has got to do a lot of work in strengthening, reviving its own relationships in the Middle East and showing that its alliances count for something. But if it can regain some confidence, the confidence of its allies in the Middle East, then there's more of a basis for talking to the Russians about some kind of cooperation there too. So you've got the basis for some discussion. A lot of it will be tense and unproductive, but some basis for sorting out the interests of both sides. I don't think you can make very much progress on any of these fronts unless you can kind of lance the boil of the Ukraine problem. There, you've got to convince Putin that, you know, what he's been doing for the past couple of years in eastern Ukraine is just is beyond the pale. He's got to walk it back somehow. It doesn't have to be utterly humiliating for him, but he can't keep doing what he's doing. If Putin, who has his poor pragmatism, is prepared to take another look at that whole issue, you know, I don't think you necessarily get a new reset, but you could end up with a new phase of transactional relations that seem productive to both sides.
Well, holy smokes, Stephen, I have learned so much today, and this is even after, you know, this is our fourth episode on this. Uh-huh. We've done a ton of
good
research coming in, and there's so much I didn't even know. So
good.
So on behalf of myself and all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really great.
A pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
You would absolutely love to.
Anytime you guys want to pour over another 25 years of history and reconstruct it all, I'm there.
Awesome. Oh, that would be great. I expect to hear from us, definitely.
Listeners, remember, on our show notes, you can find more work by Stephen Sestanovich if you want to dig in a little bit more, see what he's written about recently. We will put links up to all of that. And otherwise, thank you. Thank you for tuning in. This has been one information jam-packed episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.